Back on Downtown, time for Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt here with us. And for the second week, we'll talk about this wonderful book that I started reading over the weekend. And I mean, we have the complimentary copy here from University of Nebraska Press, but it sounded so good, I went and ordered it on Amazon, and I've been reading it myself. David Krell's book, Baseball, 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK, and every bit as good as you advertised.
Yeah, I went back and have been reading some of it again to get ready for today. I really like about this is, if you were an American studies major, you would read this book, right? Because it's about everything. It's about the culture. It's about the politics. It's about the technology, a lot of it, the space industry. It's about sports. It's about American personalities, changes in journalism, the fact that the Vietnam War is starting to crank up. There's so much going on. And Krell does a fabulous job of contextualizing. And I don't usually like that phrase, you know. But what he does is he'll set everything up. Every major event he sets up really well. And I was thinking, you know, it's the first year for the Mets and the Astros. And we talked about more about the space and the politics and the movies and stuff last time. But the New York Mets, Metropolitans, went 40-120. Okay. Casey Stengel at one point said, can't anybody around here play ball? But here's their opening day lineup. Richie Ashburn, Felix Mantilla, Charlie Neal, Frank Thomas, Gus Bell, Gil Hodges, Don Zimmer, Hubie Landreth, and Roger Craig. Now, that ought to be a pretty good baseball team.
Yeah, except
of course, they were all 900 years old at the time, right?
And Roger Craig, I had forgotten this. I looked at the numbers for his 2 years with the Mets. This is incredible. He was 15-48.
Right.
He had back-to-back 24 loss seasons.
He lost 13 games in a row at one point, and I think five of them were one-run games.
Yeah, and I think he had an ERA both years of under four.
Of under four, yeah. It was, I think, like 3.6 or something. Then the other thing that's interesting about that season in baseball. Okay, so Bo Belinsky throws the first no-hitter for the California Angels. Mr. Movie Star, good looks, Mamie Van Doren's one of his wives. His lifetime was 28-51, yet it seemed to me that Belinsky was around forever. You know,
because he hung around until 1970.
Yeah.
But up and down from the minors to the majors.
And a lot of time in the bars. And he had, you know, developed a real substance problem, which he later admitted.
But that was a great story. And I just finished that portion of the book last night when it talked about his days working for a car dealership out in Vegas and how he seemed to find peace with all of it in his last years and had conquered a lot of his demons and had some great friends that meant a lot to him.
And was apparently good at what he was doing out there, too. Yeah,
and didn't really talk about baseball unless somebody brought it up to him.
Yeah, and then you think about you know, they talk about his great looks and his charisma. Then you take a guy like Bob Aspromonte, who's playing for the Colt 45s, and people are yelling at him, hey, get out of there. You should be in Hollywood, pretty boy, right? Because he was so good looking. And I was looking at now, Harry Kraft was the first manager of the Colt 45s. He was Mickey Mantle's all-time favorite manager. Mm. In fact, when Mickey made the Yankees, he wasn't sure he didn't want to go to Beaumont for one more year to play for Kraft. But they had some players, Bob Serve, Jim Busby, Dave Roberts, Roman Mejias, Jim Pendleton, Joey Malfitano, Bob Aspromonte, who was a legitimate player, Don Budden, Billy Goodman, Norm Larker, who I sort of remember.
Who finished, I'd forgotten all about this, finished second in the National League in batting one year.
Yeah, I remembered him from baseball cards and
right.
stuff. Now, I was 11 in 1962, so baseball was my main sport. That's what I liked the best. It's what you could see the most of where I lived. Bobby Shantz was on that team, and Dean Stone. Now, they had a much better record. But what's really interesting is that what those teams ended up meaning to those cities. For New York, the return of the Mets meant the return of the National League.
Right.
As bitter as people were about losing the Dodgers and the Giants, they embraced the Mets. And 7 years later, the Mets were 1969 pretty good.
And I didn't know this until I read the book, that the Mets logo is an homage to the teams that had left. It's the orange of the Giants colors and the blue of the Dodgers.
I did not I I don't know why that escaped me, but it was a revelation to me in the book too. And the fact that that the Mets went to Queens, right? They didn't go to Brooklyn. They didn't go to Manhattan, right? They went to Queens to carve out their own identity, but they clearly became, especially for Dodger fans who may have been angrier than even the Giants fans about them leaving. They then created a National League presence in New England, which really hadn't had one. You know, right. I mean, in Connecticut, when I was growing up in Connecticut, you rooted for one of two teams, the Yankees or the Red Sox. It was a more Yankee state then than it is now. It's more of a Red Sox state now in terms of the area that's occupied. The Mets came in, and all kinds of people in Fairfield County who couldn't get tickets to Yankee games or didn't want to drive all the way to Boston started listening. And they started listening to Lindsey Nelson and Ralph Kiner, and they were good, right?
Oh, yeah.
So the Mets started bringing a competition back in New York for the back page of the sports section, which enabled all kinds of more journalists to get involved. And those journalists went on over the years to become prominent journalists, not only in New York, but sometimes elsewhere. And
a lot of them were part of that new wave of sports writers known as the Chipmunks.
The Chipmunks, as I was going to say, the Chipmunks, you know, George Vesey and all that discussion in other books that we've had about the Chipmunks is what I think is very interesting is that the New York Times, because the Herald was fading or maybe was gone by then, I don't remember when the Herald died out, the Daily News, the Times had a certain panache, which it still has because of its extraordinary journalism, but it should, and it had important sports writers, Red Smith, Dave Anderson, but it didn't have that stable like the Globe had in its heyday. And I would say actually the Globe has pretty good sports writers now too, or maybe the Tribune in Chicago. This brought sports journalism to New York in a different way, and it changed radio in New York, which he doesn't talk about much in the book. But I really remember when Bill Mazur and those guys started having afternoon sports talk shows in New York, that the whole level of discussion of sports changed, and in some ways for the better, in some ways we have what we have today. But what I really liked about this was that it also talks about those two teams, but there's that great World Series between the Yankees and the Giants. I remember in the first pack of baseball cards that I got that year, I got Jim Davenport, it was the third baseman for the Giants. I got Rocky Colavito, and I got, I'm going to forget his name. It might, now, could that be Enos Slaughter's last year? It was somebody like that. It'd been around forever, a veteran. I don't remember how long. So, Slaughter played for the Yankees in 60 or 61. But anyway, and when the World Series came around, I thought, I got a guy in the. I've got these guys that were in the World Series, and that connection was different because you could memorize, and you talked about, you've done this. I knew who played third base, started for every American League team because there weren't that many.
Right.
And you knew who played, who the stars were for every team. I don't even, if you ask me who some of the stars are today, I couldn't even tell you what team they play for. There's so many teams. I don't have that same relationship to baseball. But it was a coast-to-coast series. It was the Yankees and one of the two teams that left New York. So the animosity level was high.
And it was Mantle. It was Mays.
Mantle. It was Mays. It was Marichal and Ford. It was, and because some of the games were played during the day, the World Series, I think, was bigger than it is when it's at night because people made sacrifices. Teachers would let you watch it in school.
I remember that in 1967 when our teacher rolled that TV in for game one.
Yeah. So I think what this book really talks about is the kind of different relationship we had with everyone then. John Kennedy did not win in a landslide. It was a close election. Thank you, dead people in Chicago. And yet, once that sort of Camelot vibe happened, even people I knew, adults I knew who were vehemently against Kennedy, huge Nixon supporters, when Jackie Kennedy did that great tour of the White House and sort of let everybody in, she wasn't Mamie Eisenhower. She wasn't Bess Truman. She wasn't Eleanor Roosevelt. She was She was young, she was attractive, she was highly educated, and which is not to denigrate any of those other three women in any way, but it sort of told the American people that what he said in his inaugural speech is true.
The torch has been passed to a new generation.
And this generation, you guys look up at the stars because we're going to go there. And I would have to say that in my lifetime, nothing inspired me more than America going to the moon, because you know we had all the Sputnik scares and we had all the Russians are beating us and they're going to drop an atomic bomb from space on us and all that, and we said we were going to do it and we did it. And I think that summer of 1969, even with the Vietnam War and everything else was going on, might be the time in my life I felt most inspired. And it when you see where its roots were really in 61 right. and 62 and 63, it really made me understand why that came about.
Now, it's interesting you mention that, because in watching Summer of Soul, I got a very different perspective, because reporters asked a number of the concert goers to that Harlem Cultural Festival in July of 69, what do you think about Men on the Moon? And most of them couldn't care less, because it didn't resonate the same way with African Americans, who said, rightfully so,
yeah.
Hey, some of that money, you know, could help out the poor folks in our neighborhoods.
Right, and you know, and it's funny that also about that is, think about how later Johnson really creates a much larger black middle class by opening up civil service and the like, and equal opportunity in employment. And yes, the 68 riots sort of put a damper on a lot of that. But when by the time we get to 1969. And I look at Woodstock and the Summer of Soul and all those kinds of things. One of the things I think about is that it was also the first time people were hearing from other people who right. they didn't know. You know, I've often told people this, they it shocks them. I would have gone to an absolutely 100% all white high school, but I went away to boarding school. And because I went away to boarding school, I went to school with Latino people and African American people and people from other countries. And so, in a sense, the tide began to turn, I think, when a lot of people who had a lucky, privileged upbringing, and I never denied that I'm one of those, got to see things we hadn't otherwise seen and thought, this is pretty interesting, you know? And so much of that, I think, began that turn when Kennedy and younger people, and I don't think it's even that much... You know, people say, well, he was very progressive. Not really, you know, when you think about it on what we talk about today. But that era changed us, because white kids had black heroes, Willie Mays, Jackie Robinson, people like that. They were boxers that they admired. They were football players
musicians
and actors, you know, and Diane Carroll, people like that are starting to break these things. And I think when that happened and people began to feel safe, not in not being afraid, that we made some of the greatest leaps in progress that the country made, and certainly not without mistakes and not without leaving lots of people behind. I'm not myopic about that, but I think that year of 1962, though I certainly didn't realize it as much in 1962, when I look back, that's a big year.
Yeah, and it is, and I think decades are a funny thing. It's a very arbitrary line of demarcation, and they are rarely self-contained. And I think you can make a pretty good case that 1960 and 61 were just a continuation of the 50s,
yeah.
But that 1962 was the beginning of the decade of the 60s as we know it.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. And I think that the transformation, if you will, of the transition from the late 50s to the early 60s, a lot of people see it the wrong way. They think, oh, everybody was in the Eisenhower age was complete conformist and this and that, which is not even close to being true, or that Eisenhower was some kind of like crazy conservative, which is hardly true. But the transition was that the torch, it was the generation. Mm-hmm. It was now you could be 45 and you could count. You didn't have to wait till you were 60 to count. And I think that just made a lot of people of all colors and stations and genders dream that, yeah, this I can do this.
Well, it's a wonderful book, A 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK by David Krell, and hopefully we'll get David on.
Yes, I am. My contact in Nebraska was away from work last week, so I will get a hold of Rosemary, and we'll find out a way to do that. And we'll be talking to a Nebraska person next time, because we'll be talking to Jim Leek.
Oh, is that next week?
Yeah, about his Grover Cleveland Alexander book, which, man, if you're a baseball fan, well, let me just tease it this way. We know what DiMaggio and we know what Williams and we know what great players lost to the war. What we don't know as well, the story has not well, it's been told as well about Grover Cleveland Alexander and Christy Mathewson and some of those guys, because they didn't just lose baseball time. They didn't just lose the effort, the ability to have incredible numbers. I mean, who could imagine if Williams had played 3.5 more years? They lost their ability to play baseball as a result of going to war, and they went when they didn't have to.
The book is called The Best Team Over There. Jim Leek next week, and then week after that, Gibson Fay LeBlanc.
The poet laureate of Portland and the director of the Maine Writers and Publishers Association. His wonderful book of poetry called Deke Dangle Dive.
Excellent. Well, that's what's ahead next couple of weeks here on Sports Lit 101.